Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Under the Radar SFF Books Podcast. I'm your host, Blaze, as always. Thank you so much for listening and joining me wherever you may be around the world. And it's time for another author interview. I'm very excited about this one, as I just finished this book literally last week, and it took my breath away of all the possibilities that this epic fantasy has to offer. So please help me welcome Joaquin Baldwin to the program, the author of Wolf of Withervale and book one in the Nos Saga. So Joaquin, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Blaze. It's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me. It's actually, this is my very first podcast ever, so be kind. I haven't done this before. I'm kind of used to interviews, but are usually in Spanish because I have a lot of stuff that happens in Paraguay, where I'm from. I've done a lot of those, but usually nothing in English like this, so it's a little different for me.
Oh, well, welcome, and we're so glad to be your first podcast interview, and we'll take things nice and easy, so no need to worry about that. So, as I said, I was captured by your debut novel. I know you put a lot of time, a lot of work into it, but I wanted to start a little further back. What made you want to become an author? And you're also an illustrator. You did several different illustrations in this book as well, so give us a little background into that.
Well, to be frank, I don't know if I ever wanted to become an author or even want to be an author still now. I'm always shifting everything that I do. And honestly, I always hated writing. It was one of the things I never enjoyed in the art process. It's been very hard for me. I did a lot of work in animation, basically. And I, you know, went through writing screenplays and writing short films and doing a lot of stuff like that. And the writing process to me was always the most terrifying and the least fun. But sometimes you just want to get ideas out of your head, and that's the first step. And in this case, I thought this idea is way too big, and I'm not going to make an animated film out of this. It has to be enormous. I thought it was just going to be one novel, honestly. Then I thought, well, maybe it's a trilogy. Now it's six books, but that's how it goes. But yeah, I think it's mainly I had a set of ideas in my head that were totally disconnected, that were related more, I guess, they would have been better fitted for short sci-fi stories. And I always just kept them in the back of my mind. And I thought, I'll do something with these someday. And eventually, there was this one night where I had this short story there. I posted on Twitter where it was 4 a.m. and I just woke up, and then I had this one little nugget of an idea that tied everything together. And I'm sitting there at 4 a.m. It's like, wait, this is big. This is enormous. And I got to do something with this. And then, of course, I'm not sleeping anymore. I'm sitting there until 6, 7 a.m. just turning around in bed, trying to figure out what do I do with this. And then I just spent, you know, I was 2020 at some point. And since then, I spent pretty much every day working on this thing and nonstop. And that one little thing just tied everything together. And that's, I think, is something magical about it. Just, and I had almost like I had no choice in the matter. I just had to keep working on this. And I thought, it's not just a fun story idea, but this is a very important thing to tell. So I dedicated my entire life since then to this project.
So you kind of got swept away by the story, and you feel like you wouldn't rest until it was all written down on paper. Was this the full book one, or was this like the full series idea that got into your mind?
It's the core of the entire series. So I already had a sense of what the beginning and the end of the story would be at that point. Of course, things changed quite drastically since then, but it was the idea for the entire series. And that's actually a tricky thing. Like, I know one of your critiques of my book was how slow it was at the beginning. And that is a very fair critique. And there's a reason for that honestly, book one is not book one. Book one is a portion of the entire book. So this is one story told in six books. I just had to find a place to split them because it's a really massive story. So the first half of book one is almost like an introduction to the world and the characters, and then the story starts. So in a sense, I was planning everything as a single story. Of course, I had to have breaking points and, you know, character arcs that, you know, little beats that conclude in each one of the books, stuff like that. But overall, it's one massive storyline.
Yeah, and I didn't mean like the story is slow as a negative. I'm just saying it's building the world and is building the characters up to a point where the pacing starts to pick up a little bit. And but once it does, I couldn't put the book down. And you and I will talk off screen as to that exact chapter, that spoiler territory. But it was a lot of fun. Now, you mentioned when your idea for this first came to mind, like, you thought it could be like a short sci-fi like film or something like that. What you do fantastically is you're blending, you blend elements of fantasy and there's some elements of science fiction as well. Is that like, are those types of stories or even types of like films or anything that you love to do combining the two? Or do you feel like you wanted to do one versus the other? I'm just curious.
To me, as to be honest, what you read so far is just barely touching into those concepts, because I'm trying to slowly deliver those ideas through the six books. And to me, I think it's, I personally enjoy worlds that are, you know, tightly grounded, where if there is magic, there's an explanation. I don't think every writer needs to do that. That's just my particular taste. But I also, I think that there's enough magic in, you know, in our actual world, if you just see how things work, the beauty of nature itself, stuff like that, that I want to rescue in some way, instead of saying we need this to be magical. We already have a lot of magic in the way things operate in our regular daily lives. And I wanted to rescue some of that and put into the concepts in there without going into something that feels futuristic. And so I was trying to find a way to do that. And I developed my own magic system that would be plausible in a world of that kind, in say medieval Renaissance kind of time. So, and but I didn't want it to have a sci-fi flavor to it. I definitely wanted to feel like fantasy. So it's a tricky thing to manage, but yeah, if, once you get to, you know, particularly on book five, without any spoilers, you'll see where this all leads. It's a very slow build up to reveal what this all means, but it's extremely tightly grounded, and also it's ready for expansion, which I'm excited about. Like, this is a nice system that could work with a, you know, tabletop RPG kind of level thing. And, you know, I'm not going to work on that yet, but it's something that I'm excited about that could work in the future.
Well, we're very excited to hear that. That's awesome. So with that, why don't we talk a little bit about the world building? Because I feel like we need to set the scene a little bit before we dive into the characters and the magic system that you think. So the world of Nos, it's the second planet from this world's sun. And throughout the land, there's these huge domes. These domes are massive. They're, I think you wrote 80 miles in diameter and in length. So, but they're unable to be, you're not able to go into them, you're not able to see what's in it. So it's always been a mystery to like the scholars and like the students and the people of the land. There's also an empire trying to gather all the power and invade. But you set like the scene of something like mysterious in the world. Because so when the idea came into your mind about these huge domes, and there's massive amounts of them throughout the land, what were your thoughts? I mean, what did you want the reader to see when they were jumping into like the first couple chapters?
For me, the domes was just mostly a device to hide information from the readers in a way. It was just, I needed certain things to be hidden and some things from the past to not be accessible. And so Nos is a bit, it's not a post-apocalyptic type of story, but there was a cataclysm that happened about 1500 years ago. And since that point, basically civilization was rebuilt, but it's not like we live in a wasteland fallout style. It's, everything is green and happy and everything is thriving again. But through that, somehow these domes showed up in the environment and no one really knows why they're there or how they showed up, which sounds like how would you not notice that these things showed up? And that's explained in book two a little better. To me, it's basically, I didn't want it to be an episodic kind of tale, but I wanted to be, how would you say it? To have some kind of leveling, like you go from one place to another and gather more information and start opening new treasure chests of sorts.
Progression.
A progression that wasn't just one episode after another. And so I kind of set it up that way, where these domes basically hold the key to all this, you know, the major story that will develop. And at the beginning, it's just a teaser. You barely get to know what they are about. In book two, you finally learn what they are about. And then, you know, from there on, it's a bigger adventure. But I don't know. I just like the mystery of them. And I also try to explain them logically. They sound completely implausible, but once you get into it and you actually learn how they were created and what's within them, then you finally start to understand how this was doable.
Yeah, and you hold a lot of mysteries in those domes, and you have to read the book to find out. We're not going to spoil that for you here. So we follow. We're also going to talk about the magic system, because we're introduced to that very early on in the book. It revolves around these. You have a word for them in the book, and I can't find it at the moment. But
etheric elements, yeah.
Yes, through these masks. There's in the beginning. There's this. I'll talk a little bit about the beginning. There's this wolf that's hiding, that's running from these hunters from the Empire trying to capture it. And then it comes into one of our characters, which we'll talk about later, who hides it. And then it turns out that the white fox is actually, it's an older woman wearing a magical mask. This changed her. And that's the premise for like the magic. Because when the mask is put on, you're able to see, you describe it as threads. You're able to see the threads of like nature, and also their happiness, their joy, but their pain, and how it interconnects with things around them and objects. And it's written beautifully. You have beautiful writing as well. Can you talk a little bit about how the magic system works up to like what we see in book one, and like what you're hoping the readers to see when they go into learning about the magic system?
Yeah, I'll drop a little more information that's in book two, but without getting spoilery for this, because otherwise it's impossible to quite understand. What you were saying about the masks, and I was actually saying something about the etheric elements, even though they sound disconnected, that's actually part of the magic system. The masks have a rational explanation of how they work with transformation and everything else. And the main core of the magic system works through what I call the etheric elements, which is basically... not sure if every element, but a lot of elements are known to have an etheric counterpart, which they look and react exactly the same as the regular element, except there's one little thing that is off about them, and that is their what you want to call their magical property, whatever it is. So in the case of carbon, the etheric variant is soot, and soot has a particular way of basically linking conscious creatures in some way by means of these threads are basically in a way a way to explain consciousness and self-awareness and life itself. And then there's other elements are, it's more mechanical properties. Like for example, magnium is the etheric variant of iron, and it basically imbues magnetic properties to elements that it alloys with. Or brine is the etheric variant of sulfur, and it's basically a permanently hot rock, so it creates heat. And the counterpart to that would be frisson, which is not mentioned in book one yet. It's basically an element that is always cold, or produces or removes heat. So everything balances out too in some ways. And through all these weird elements, there's only some that I described, there's others that will remain mysterious. All of these are the ones that create these magical properties. So in a way, you can have a chemical compound. And normally it would be, you know, a rock, inert. But if you use a certain series of elements, you might have something completely different with something that feels like a magical property of sorts. And through this, in some way, the masks are linked. I'm not going to say how, but that's, the masks are basically the main magical artifact in the books. So in the case of the Candid mask that shows up at the very beginning with the gray fox, you don't really know what its magical properties are at the beginning, but you start learning slowly through Lago's point of view. And of course, one thing that's obvious from the cover to the marketing materials, everything that's related to transformation. So that's not quite a spoiler, but there's some sense of something is going to happen, and there's going to be some kind of sense of self-discovery through these masks, and transformation will take a big part in that.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing. And yeah, learning about the masks and the transformation and the properties and the magical elements, it was just amazing to read, because you can tell you put a lot of work into this and the world building and all this around it. So I appreciate that ever so much. And you're doing it at a slow pace so that the payoff would be massive towards the end. And you start to get that payoff at the end, and very much looking forward to book two. So when we talk about we'll talk about the two main characters for the time being. So the main character we spend most of the time with is Lago. So it lives in Withervale. He has no mother. His mother died in childbirth. He has a very rough, rugged, sometimes abusive father who sometimes is a little too hard on him. And for Lago, his main way of like making himself happy, apart from like talking to his teacher, is to actually paint his fingernails, which was a nice touch. It's different from any other main character I've read in the epic fantasy series. And he's the one who discovers the Great Fox, and he's the one, the mask and all this other stuff. So talk to us about Lago, how he first came into your mind, and the type of character you had in mind when you were writing him.
Lago is, of course, because he's the protagonist, of course, I'm going to put a lot more of myself into him. But at the same time, I'm afraid sometimes that my readers will think, oh, this writer, this author must have been abused as a kid or something with bad parents or whatever. But I'm like, no, that's actually not my own experience. My parents are great. My mom is very alive. My dad is not an asshole. I'm trying to put certain ideas in there that mostly derive from other types of prejudice that I might have experienced directly or indirectly, but it's not that's my own personal life necessarily. And I don't even paint my nails. Actually, the first time I ever painted my nails was to do a Lago cosplay that I did a series of photos. So that was just, about a month ago. It's the first time I ever done it. But I thought, I want someone who feels, who sees beauty in nature and in themselves and the differences that, who has some aspect that they can be, that people might find something easy to bully him up for. And so that's just a little thing to start with. And honestly, the whole painting nails thing was very small at the beginning, and it became a bigger ritual. And then by now it becomes a very important motif through the entire six books. And I know I like Lago. He's very adventurous. He's a bit nerdy. He has his flaws. He's very temperamental. He's a little stubborn. But I feel like you're probably going to mention Alea at some point. She's also she's kind of like, I don't know, the Jiminy Cricket on Lago's shoulder kind of thing. And she's the voice of reason at points. And so I feel like these characters try to complement each other in some ways. And with Lago or with any of the other characters, what I try to do is I always put a little bit of myself into them. Even the villains, I'm like, I want to find how I relate to Fiorna, to Alvis, to any of these other, the obvious villainous characters in the story. I don't want them to just be caricatures. So I'm going to find something that I feel is very important to myself and place it in those characters so I can relate to them. And with Lago, I think I put most of it in there. It's just all this nerdiness about loving the stars and nature and trying to learn about the universe and understanding the cosmos, all that stuff is in there. That I want him to be an inspirational character. But at the same time, you'll find a lot of flaws in him, particularly later in the books. He has his ups and downs.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing. I love Lago's reading about him. He might be a little bit naive. He leaves too much with his heart on his sleeve sometimes, but that's how we learn and grow. And he does grow over the course of at least the first book. And I'm assuming he grows tremendously over the course of the six books. And you're right. You did mention Alea, Lagos' best friend. Now, she is a different race from Lago completely. What's called an Uldren, darker skin. They have extra like bones on their body that protrude from their skin. She actually has like a horn. And she also works in the mines, which is looked upon as like, in society, is like kind of a lesser job. So you see certain types of prejudice around among certain races and certain people. But that just brings to the bigger question of there's so many different types of races that you introduce into this world. What made you want to do it, like write a story like this, certain different types of races and people putting in? And because this is very expansive and probably required a lot of thought and foresight.
Yeah, I think to me, it's world building is just fun to begin with. I wanted to have a lot of different cultures. I like writing about cultures, about practices, religions, anything. And book one touches on only a very, very small amount of that anyway. But I also didn't want this to be a perfect world. I think the natural aspect of it is beautiful, but there's still human nature involved. And so prejudice, slavery, stuff like that will be present. And so to me, it was important to show that people can overcome that. Like Alea is a perfect example. She's basically a slave, even though that's not the word they use directly. But she doesn't give a shit. She's happy. She knows who she is, and she does her best no matter what happens. And she's going to show that she's going to be hopeful and positive through whatever adversities. And then I wanted a sense of something fantastical in this world that doesn't feel like, oh, is this, you know, Earth a few thousand years later or something like that. So I threw some elements in there, like the Aldrin having those protruding bones out of their bodies. There's other races that we haven't met yet that have slightly, you know, not quite pronounced stuff. You're not going to find blue people or, you know, or people with feathers or anything like that. It's not that level of variation in races. I try to keep everything consistent to what could, you know, commonly evolve, because I want to keep it grounded again. So I added a couple of minor tweaks here and there just to make sure that visually these things are distinct. And then culture wise, I have a ton of information, like, you know, from gods to religions, to practices, rituals, whatever, that don't even make it into the books, but they're just there for flavor, mentioned here and there. You'll see later, in particular in book 2, once we start meeting these other races, where it becomes really big and you start feeling like you expect that one race will be just a variation of the other, and then everything is completely different. And I'm trying to break those expectations that, you know, this is the tribe and this is a tribal thing. It's like, well, what the fuck does tribe mean? It's not that simple. You want to have something to differentiate these cultures very drastically. So I have a lot of fun with that. To me, it's one of the most fun parts of world building, trying to figure out who are these people and how do they think and how do they speak and what influences the way they dress and the way they see the world, basically.
Right. And the main conflict is once Lago comes into possession of this mask, in a way, they're actually being, because the mask is being hunted by the Empire trying to find them. So they are forced to flee. So can you tell us a little bit about the Empire through the characters of Forna and how you wanted them to be portrayed as pure evil hunting all these powerful relics?
So yeah, Fjorna and Alvis Hallow, they are, in book 1, basically the most prominent villains in there. And to me, it's a... Yeah, the Empire just represents this greed and hunger for power in some ways. It gets a little more complex than that later too. But the masks, even though it feels like it's just a minor magical artifact of the main characters at first, the mask is a lot more powerful than it seems, of course. And that's why the Empire is chasing after it. There's a secret of the mask that can unlock a lot of basically riches and power for the wielders. And this is what they're after. And it's a way to start a conflict where I feel like the entire war that's coming, it's bigger than just an empire versus the Union or something. It's a worldwide thing for all of Nos. And so I'm just trying to start to set up that conflict that is going to show up. And I don't think this is a spoiler because I already released images of this, but there's more than one mask. It's something that you find out later. And through this, it becomes a race to see who can manage to control the most of these powerful artifacts. And that is one of the key things that develops through the rest of the saga. And the Empire basically becomes this extremely ambitious and evil figure that just tries to demolish, exterminate anything that's on their way just to get to the mask, because the masks are so powerful, and basically they will allow them to control anything at the end of the day.
Yeah, it becomes, as you said, it becomes like an arms race to who can have the most power and find the most masks. Excellent. There's one question regarding, I don't know if it's too much into spoilers, but I just have to ask it. So there's the masks, and they have a name for them once they put them on and become powerful. But there's also... there's spirit creatures who we meet one of them later, but I'm just curious because I couldn't really pinpoint it when I was reading it. What is like the main differences between the person wearing the mask and like the spirit creature who like resides over it? I couldn't really find what the main difference was and how they're like connected, so to speak.
And they are very connected, honestly. And that's there's a subtle difference there that Well, in a way, the spirits for each, what I'm calling the clades. Clades are basically types of creatures or groups, taxonomical groups of creatures. That goes into nerdy stuff. But so let's say canids or felids or ursids or whatever. It's different types of groups of creatures. They have a spirit animal of sorts, which is called a nu'irg. And they are basically, in a way, the representation of the combined consciousness of the entire clade. It's this being that comes to be basically from the complexity of the consciousness of the entire whole of that particular clade. So in a way, they represent the health and the diversity of that clade, but they are their own creatures at the same time. They have their own feelings, their own bodies, their own everything. They have some magical properties which are related to transformation once again. The masks themselves are not natural. They are constructed, but they tapped into that same power. So that's how they are related. So a mask is linked to a clade. For example, the canid mask linked to the canid clade, including canines and vulpines and others. And so in that case, that mask can tap onto the same power that the nu'irgesh for that clade are tapping. So basically they are very tightly related, but one is natural and the other one is not.
Excellent. That's one question I definitely wanted to ask you when coming on. So apart from being an author, you're also an artist. You did several illustrations in this first book, which are just breathtakingly gorgeous. Could you just tell us a little bit of your process of creating like a concept art or like a drawing or any type of painting? And like, how did the process go for like creating just one of these into the book and having to put them out? Because I'm very curious.
Well, I'm primarily a visual artist anyway. So to me, if I wasn't writing, I would have been doing illustrations either way for whatever ideas I wanted to illustrate. So I thought, if I'm going to be writing, I'm going to be illustrating as well, because I'm not going to be able to hold myself from just sitting and typing letters. I need to actually be drawing at some point. So from the very start, I thought this was going to be a visual project as well. I also love maps, so that was part of the whole thing I wanted to work on. And to me, as always, I am a visual thinker and visual writer as well. When I write, you probably notice I use quite extensive descriptions that are very specific and very colorful. And these are very vivid images that are in my head already. And I want to get them out. I need to get them out of my head. So I normally sit around and find key moments that are important for me to tell. And also that are relatively economic to illustrate because I don't have all the time in the world. So I find something that I will be able to tackle right away. And I just simply sketch it out. I already have it in my head in some ways. And I start by just doing a very quick sketch. And my process usually ends up involving photo references because I need to see something to modify in a way. And so I end up photographing myself in different poses and then sketching completely over that and repainting everything and redesigning everything based on that. But having a base to work from really helps me as I'm visualizing. And then I have decades of experience with 3D software, which is what my daily job at Disney involves. So what I tend to do is block things in 3D and use that as a reference as well, and sometimes render basic components that I will end up incorporating into the illustrations. But I'm trying to make everything look handmade and kind of watercolor textures and graphite textures and stuff like that. So it's a very complicated mix of stuff. But yeah, I'm very happy with that. It's one of the parts of this whole thing that really brings me joy is seeing the visuals in the end. I'm trying to add up at least 12 or so illustrations per book at this moment. I'll keep adding more later, but whatever goes into print at the moment of release is probably going to be at least a dozen really full color illustrations.
Awesome. They're just breathtaking. And thank you so much for including them in the hardback cover copies. Can't wait to see what else you got. So the entire Nos Saga is a 6-book epic fantasy series. How's it going for the rest of the books? Maybe tell them when we can expect to see like the book 2, and how is the whole series written, or are you still finishing touches on them?
Yeah, one of the things that I'm excited about this is that I actually completely finished the core story, writing all six books before publishing book one. And this has been the best thing that I could have done. I'm so happy that I didn't just hurry it and try to publish what I had. My first version of book one was pretty solid, but there's so much that I added in book six that ended up affecting edits that I did in book one later. And it's incredible. It's so much that changed and different concepts that I added, even things related to the etheric elements that I hadn't thought about until I got to the very end of the fucking thing. And so I went back, it's like, well, I need to add this here. And I kept just dropping these connections and setups and payoffs that are so far apart from each other, but are so satisfying. And so I finished writing all six books. I have a really cool team of beta readers that the majority of them are currently reading book four, while I am editing book three, because they already send me their notes for book three. So I have a lot to work on there. And my editor, Andy, he's currently working on book two. He's about 85% or 90% done currently. So once he's done with that edit, he'll send those notes to me, and I have to go back to book two to basically, take all those notes and clean it up at the very end. So it's a lot of books at the same time. Book one is really ready, but I'm still, finding little typos or whatever that I'm correcting. Book two is with the editor. Book three, I'm actually editing them about 60% done right now. Book four is with the beta readers, and five and six is with a few beta readers that are a little more ahead than the others. I'm calling book five and six alpha, not beta at the moment, because I'm missing like one or two chapters. I just wrote a note like, I need a new chapter with this character here because it feels like we need to check in with them. And that's about it. But the core story is there. It's basically all finished. I already had an idea what the story was gonna be and how it's gonna end. So I arrived at that, and it became better and bigger than I expected. But it's all there, and it's really satisfying how it completes itself from the beginning, because it was planned from the very, very beginning.
That's amazing, having the whole thing already done. Hopefully later this year, we get to see book two. I'm very excited about that as well. And just one final question, either as an author or the work you do outside of being an author and an illustrator, who are your main influences or people who inspired you to do what you currently do? I'm curious.
There's a bunch of different writers. Obviously Tolkien is the biggest one, just because I grew up reading Lord of the Rings, and it was the first time I really felt involved into a fantasy world like that. Probably Neil Gaiman is the biggest influence nowadays. It's just his empathic way of writing, and the way he deals with magic, and the way his voice sounds throughout his entire through all his work. It's just there's this kindness to his voice that is fascinating. And the same with Patrick Rothfuss, probably, even though that's more recent for me. Then Jemisin has been a great influence recently too, for world building and something that a new take in with fantasy. Stephen King with the Dark Tower series, it's very subtle, but my opening lines for Wolf of Witherill are slightly echoing the opening from The Dark Tower from The Gunslinger. So it's not the man in black fled through the desert, but the gray fox fled through the forest. So it's something similar. But the main thing too is that I'm not only influenced by fiction writers, but nonfiction. I grew up reading Carl Sagan and Richard Feynman, Stephen Hawking, and mostly Carl Sagan, I think, is one of the greatest influences for my writing. I want people to feel excited about discovery, about learning about the cosmos, about understanding how things work and how there's beauty in all that. And I try to throw that into my writing as well every chance I get. And I even have sometimes there are certain characters when I write them, I imagine Carl Sagan's voice in my head, and like, how would he phrase this? And how, that very smooth, soothing tone that he has. And I kind of try to, envision his voice through these characters as well.
Awesome. That's quite a lot of people to influence you. And they definitely paid off in the book that you have, and hopefully for the rest of the series, it's the same as well. So Joaquin, this has been a lot of fun. Could you tell our listeners where they could find you, like your social media handles, your website, and when they can find Wolf of Withervale?
Yeah, my main website is my name, JoaquinBaldwin.com. That's J-O-A-Q-U-I-N, Baldwin.com. And social media, I'm pretty much on all the main ones as J-O-A Baldwin. Mostly nowadays, I use Blue Sky. I don't want to deal with Twitter anymore. I'm on Facebook, and I will post cross-post to Instagram and what else? Yeah, mostly Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky. Those are the main ones. But try to find me in Blue Sky. That's where I post most of the stuff. But as every other author out there, probably newsletter is the best way to get the news quicker and sooner and before everyone else. I'm going to be, you know, announcing book two stuff very soon, and also stuff related to the masks. I don't know if you've seen the 3D printed masks that I have. Those are coming out for sale pretty soon as well. And it's going to be a limited edition of just 100. So I'm going to announce to my newsletter before anywhere else. And yeah, that's the best way to keep in touch with you.
Awesome. No, I didn't hear about the 3D mask. So it's definitely something I'll be taking a look at.
I'll send you a link. Yeah.
please do. So great. Thank you so much for joining me. This has been a lot of fun. Hopefully we can have you back a little later when a couple more books in the series are done, and then we can do a deep dive discussion about it. I'd love to have you back.
That'll be great. I'd love to be able to talk without avoiding so many spoilers. So at that point, it'll be a lot easier.
It'll be a very special and fun interview. So thank you again for joining me, and to everyone for listening. Cheers, everybody.